Good morning, everyone. I'm going to begin my talk with a joke. So it requires a little imagination. Imagine that we're in the midst of the jungle. And it's the hottest day in decades. And extremely humid and hot. And the leaves are dripping with humidity. And it's so hot that all the insects and all the little burrowing animals are finding shade and digging into the ground to find the cool soil. And as we pan across this kind of world of green, you see something in the distance. And you focus in on it, and you see that it's this small oasis. And in this little pond, there are these two hippopotamuses up to their noses in the water, just sitting there completely motionless. And at one point, some splashing happens at the other side of the pond. Two hippos. Look, and they just come back, just sitting there. And after some time, one of the hippos sighs and says, "God, I can't believe it's Tuesday." That was actually the joke. I didn't change anything. And I was, for that, the joke's sake only, I was a little upset, but I was a little sad to see that it was so cool this morning. Like, it's not going to go over as well. But it seemed appropriate, as animals seem to be in the theme of this week's talks. And it's weird. I thought that maybe a group midway through session would laugh more than anyone else. Lots of weird stuff going here. And it is Tuesday. I can't believe it's Tuesday. After this evening, we will be at the halfway point of the session. Time swiftly passes by. And there's also a quality of something unknown going on in that joke. Like Miyoko Sensei said the other day, I don't know what's going on here. What a powerful teaching that was for me. Because obviously at that moment, something seriously intense was going on, right? Something seemed to move her deeply. But I don't know what it is. And later on in the evening, Roshi commented that Miyoko was not only speaking about giving, but showed us giving. So, how was that showing giving? There are some visual artists in this room, and perhaps they know of this book that was written back in the 1970s called Drawing from the Right Side of the Brain. In the book, it's discussed generally how artists aren't necessarily better at drawing than others, but better at seeing. So there's the left side of our brain, and actually, as a footnote, I actually read that since this book has been written, that this theory has been debunked. There's not really a left or right side of the brain, but this quality still exists in us. And so the left side of our brain, the analytical, logical side, and the right side of our brain, the creative and expressive side. And the left side, the analytical, logical side, doesn't want too much information about the things it perceives. Just enough to recognize and categorize. So when someone is drawing something, for instance, the left brain takes a quick look and says, right, that's a chair. That's enough to know. In fact, don't even bother to look at it because I have a ready-made symbol for you. Here it is. Add a few details if you like, but don't bother me with this looking business. And in doing so, the object has not been seen, and the picture comes out lifeless and primitive. There is an exercise in the book where the artists are to take the picture that they're going to draw, and they turn it upside down and draw it from that perspective. Then what happens is that you no longer see a chair or a shoulder or a knee, but you see a line. You see a shape that the eye and subsequently the hand follow. And the results of the before and after pictures of these amateur artists are astonishing. One looks like a three-year-old scribbling. The other looks like almost a professional, seasoned artist. You wouldn't believe it was the same person. And all that happens from stopping the left side of the brain, or the knowing side, the knowing part of our mind. So Myoko Sensei read the passage from Dogen. When you leave the way to the way, you attain the way. At the time of attaining the way is also left to the way. When treasure is left just as treasure, treasure becomes giving. You give yourself to yourself and others to others. And then there was a great pause. And she said, I don't know what's going on here. And in that very moment, she showed us Dogen's passage right there. Just like seeing the lines of the chair and not categorizing it as chair. And so probably many of us have found that it is this knowing mind, that continually gets us into trouble. Obviously, there are many things that we need our knowing mind for. It's necessary for survival. But there are many things that we do not need it for. And it has a hard time believing that. It's our knowing mind that punishes us for making mistakes. Roshi read a verse the other day about the stream whose ancient source still bubbles forth. It's a mistake, my modern friends, to wound the heart to try and cross that stream. So why do we wound our hearts to try and cross the stream? Roshi also mentioned in the talk comparing mind as being extremely insidious. And I must admit that I'm quite guilty of comparing mind. Comparing mind has told me many stories. And I'll share one of them. I have this old story that my comparing mind has told me that when I notice something great in someone, when I notice the greatness of someone, that it is an affirmation that I do not have greatness. So therefore, someone else's greatness is threatening. So historically, I would either, one, try to fool them into thinking I'm just as great, even though I don't believe it, or to find something bad about them to make myself feel better. It's pretty effed up, huh? And also maybe not so unique. So luckily we are here at Sesshin and have the opportunity to have an experience like Soshin related yesterday when she was lying in bed and she had the realization that she completely misinterpreted someone's actions and turned it into one of her stories, one of her cows. So we are in a place where we can see our minds the same way the artist sees a shape. Something can come up and we can just see it. Oh, this is what I do. In my mind, I'm trying to find something bad about this person. And then when that comes up and you can see it, how ridiculous it is can also present itself to you. In a sense, we don't see ourselves for who we really are, and we give up our free will. In a sense, we don't have a choice. The story pops up and it imprisons us. And we draw that same chair that we've been drawing all our lives and fail to see the chair that is right in front of us. When we see it, we can choose another way. We can draw a new line. In my case, instead of fearing the one who I regard as great, I can recognize the greatness and maybe give a compliment, and also allow space for both of us to have greatness, because there is certainly plenty of room for it. And then I'm not imprisoned by my story anymore. But it is still there. The story is still there. And for me, this has been a very important point, because the story is also a part of our personal fabric. It is a part of that which makes you, you. And this is important because the negation of the story as a part of your life is going back to the comparing mind, going back to the knowing mind. That story is a part of you, who you are. It's just a story. It's not reality, but it is a part of you. And if we can look at our stories the same way the artist looks at the curvatures of a shape and see it for what it is, without labeling it, then something different can happen. We can choose to do something that is not controlled by the story. When treasure is left just as treasure, treasure becomes giving. is this treasure? Can you believe that you are the treasure that you give to yourself and others? And what if we have deep sadness, loss, trauma, pain? Can you believe that the treasure includes all of it? All of who you are? Do you cease to be a treasure with all of your ugly truths? Every day we hear the Eno say, "May we exist in muddy water with purity like a lotus." Think about that. I'm sure we've all heard the analogy of the lotus, but without the muddy, there's no flower. Ryokan, the 18th century Zen hermit, monk, poet, wrote this verse. "I sit quietly, listening to the falling leaves. A lonely hut, a life of renunciation. The past has faded, things are no longer remembered. My sleeve is wet with tears." The past has faded, things are no longer remembered. My sleeve is wet with tears. Why do you think his sleeve is wet with tears? Do you think he shunned his stories? Okay, so part two of the talk now. I'm going to talk a little, some of you heard me talk about this before, but Perfect to talk about this right now, I think. And I want to talk about the Italian cinema movement that happened right after World War II. That was called neorealism. So in 1945, right after World War II ended, the Italian movie industry and also country was in shambles. The Germans had confiscated all the film materials and had turned all the studios into factories. And those factories were promptly bombed by the Allies. And what was left of them became refugee camps. So at this point, the Italian filmmakers were completely on their own, without studios, with extremely limited equipment, and sometimes not even any actors. So they used on-location settings with very small crews and sometimes non-actors. And at this time, the country was in a desperate need of being reborn, desperate to define themselves after 20 years of fascism and war. Italian films before the war were more of the fantasy epic. They were incredible in themselves as well. Giant sets with hundreds of actors set in biblical times, epic dramas that were essentially an escape from reality. In neorealism, for the first time, illusion took the back seat to reality. It was a response to a terrible moment in history, a need to dissolve the barrier between documentary and feature film. After the years of suppression and after being completely broken by the war, neorealism was somewhat of a prayer for the rest of the world to look at the Italians and see their humanity. The neorealists didn't necessarily want to make these pictures. In a sense, they had to. beyond everything else, neorealism came to exist out of moral and spiritual necessity. And what a gift that was. If any of you know any of these films, most famous perhaps is The Bicycle Thief. But what a gift these films continue to be. When treasure is left just as treasure, treasure becomes giving. When treasure is left just as treasure, just as what is. In the Italian's case, a painful and extremely difficult time. That was the treasure. Can we all look at ourselves and each other and see our humanity? And can you see that in yourself as treasure? So, I had to give you that little background because I want to talk about one of these films. And the film is by the same director that did The Bicycle Thief. And this one is called Umberto D. Martin Scorsese said of this film, "Umberto D is a great film about what it is to stand by and watch helplessly as you slip into poverty and even your dignity becomes excess baggage." And it's, basically, Umberto D is a story about an old man and his dog. Umberto D is an elderly man living on a measly pension. He's being threatened eviction from his room that he rents, and he has been forced to eat in soup kitchens. And when he eats, his beloved dog, Flike, also has to eat. And he'll secretly feed the dog under the table, and the people from the soup kitchen come over and scold him and tell him if he does that again, he won't be allowed into the kitchen anymore. As his dignity is slowly eaten away, having to sell all his possessions, loneliness becomes his way of life. His dog is all he has left in the world. And one day when Umberto has to go to the hospital, his landlady lets Flike run away. He comes back and immediately runs out and frantically searches all over the town at the local dog pounds for Flike. And he finally does find him. But he's at his rope's end at this point. And he's unable to bring himself to beg. There's this really beautiful scene when he goes into a courtyard and he's pantomiming, trying to practice, putting his hand out. And at this one point, a man is about to give him change. And he looks up at the sky and he goes like this, pretending that he was checking for rain. So, unable to bring himself to beg and at his rope's end, he finally decides that suicide would be the best thing. But first, he has to make sure that Flike will be taken care of. He looks into several different options for Flike. One is like a local kind of private kennel where these vicious dogs are tied up and barking at him. And another time he finds a very sweet little girl that wants to take the dog, but his parents won't let him. None of his options pan out. So one day while Flike is wandering through the park, Umberto sees that as his opportunity, and he backs away, and he runs into some bushes and hides. But Flike knows his master's scent, and he eventually finds him in the bushes. So without knowing what else to do, he takes Flike in his arms and walks towards the train tracks. Everybody else is walking away, and he's walking towards. The whistle blows, and the train is coming. The old man does not move. Flake squeals and finally jumps from his arms and runs away. And then the train rushes by Umberto. This close, and he rushed by it. Umberto runs after Flake, but the dog doesn't respond. Now he's not so sure. But finally, Flake reluctantly moves towards Umberto, and the film ends with the two of them playing in the park. He finds a pine cone, and that becomes the toy. So, like Miyoko said in her talk the other day, we have no idea how we affect others. Even that little dog. When you leave the way to the way, you attain the way. At the time of attaining the way is always left to the way. When treasure is left just as treasure, treasure becomes giving. You give yourself to yourself and others to others. When you leave the way, you attain the way. So what is the way? Joshu said, like tossing a ball on swift flowing water. A monk asked, Tao Tzu, what is the meaning of tossing a ball onto swift flowing water? Tao Tzu said, moment to moment, nonstop flow. So maybe as we go into the second half of this session, we can see our experience like a ball moving down swift flowing water. The swift flowing water of the stream where the ancient source still bubbles forth. From one moment to the next, moment to moment, nonstop flow.
Sentient beings are